So we've been, a couple weeks ago, we started studying the Diamond Sutra, you know, which was formulated as part of the Prajnaparamita literature about 800 years. Actually starting probably about 400 years after Buddha's death. Very profound, the oldest printed, dated book in existence. So I'm going to try something a little bit new here. Bear with me. We're going to have some audio-visual. And I'm new at this. I'm very kind of a low-tech kind of guy. But I'm learning. Let's see if I can actually do this. YouTube. On the Diamond Sutra. I'm the Diamond Sutra. Let's see if it happens. Come on. Oh, okay. Sharon Jonas at the Sun Valley Opera House, chanting.
Now I'm going to sing a little bit of the Diamond Sutra, sung in English. It's one of the main Buddhist texts.
Can you hear this a little bit?
Yes. Yeah.
And it says several times that if you took all the Ganges rivers and then you took all the grains of sand and the Ganges River, and each one became another Ganges River. And then you took all those Ganges Rivers put together, and you filled each one with all the seven jewels of all the worlds, then all that wealth would not be worth even 1/100, 1/1000, or 1/10000 of the merit of hearing, reading, or reciting even 4 lines of this scripture.
That's the center. I'm not going to do the whole thing.
And this is chapter 12, and it's called The Naming of the Sutra. And this is a conversation between the Buddha and his disciple Subhuti. Should be called the Diamond Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, because it has the capacity to cut through illusions and bring us to the shore of liberation. This is how you should receive and hold it. Why? Because that which the Buddha calls wisdom is not wisdom. Subhuti, what does this mean? Does the Tathagata have a teaching to explain? Subhuti replied, world honored one, the Tathagata has no teaching to explain. Subhuti, what do you think? Are there many particles of dust contained in the universe? Subhuti replied, many world honored one. Subhuti, the Tathagata teaches that these particles of dust are not real but are merely called particles of dust. The Tathagata teaches that the universe is not real but is merely called the universe. Subhuti, what do you think? Can the Tathagata be discerned by means of his 32 physical characteristics? No, world-honored one, he cannot. Why? Because the 32 bodily characteristics that are taught by the Tathagata are in fact not real. Therefore, they are called the 32 physical characteristics. if on the one hand a virtuous man.
The signless. That's what in chapter 12. I was going to end today with that. Not actually a kind of introductory to that. See if I can find where I was. The Buddha, you know, is marked by signs in the sense you can find the Tathagata on the physical plane. Often when you look at a statue of, you know, the Buddha, various statues have elongated earlobes, you know, and marks on the hands and little curlicues on the head. If you look closely, not at all statues, but there's sort of these marks. But what the Buddha is saying, the Tathagata, the Tathagata means one of the words, one of the names for the Buddha, which is more than just his physical presence. You know, the physical presence is what we call the Nirmanakaya or Shakyamuni Buddha, how the Buddha manifests in this world. That the Tathagata is actually more like, in Christianity, like the Holy Ghost, which is more than just the physical. He's actually manifesting the divine in his own body. So he's saying when you, the Tathagata actually you can't identify the Tathagata by his marks. What do you think, Subhuti? Is it possible to grasp the Tathagata by means of bodily signs? No, honored one. When the Tathagata speaks of bodily signs, there are no signs being talked about. So, saying whatever, what the Diamond Sutra is saying again and again is that whatever we perceive, whatever signs we perceive are limited. Whatever you try to attach a concept to is limited. And so what the sutra is encouraging us to do is to look beyond signs, you know, as we were talking about last week. So I wanted to, as part of an introduction, I was starting to read, talk to, where's Meg? I guess I, Meg, you encouraged me last night to pick up another birthday present here. And I, I don't know if David Brooks has ever read the Diamond Sutra. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, he's the kind of conservative columnist, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He's the one on public, the NewsHour. He's the one that kind of plays against Mark Shields. Mm-hmm. And he's the one that says, no, you know, government program doesn't, I don't know, you know. And Shields is saying, no, we've got to take care of people. These government programs are really important. And, I don't know, the government program. But he's a very wise person, and I listen to him a lot because he gets me to shift my natural inclination towards kind of progressive liberal thinking to really understand and try to understand where the other side is coming from, because he's a very deep thinker. And this is a beautiful book, The Social Animal by David Brooks. He says, I like it tongue-in-cheek, he says, me writing about emotions is a little like Gandhi talking about gluttony. Which I think is pretty good. He's very humble, right? But he's basically doing this as kind of an antidote. You know, I can tell he's more of a thinker, and he's trying in his own practice to penetrate and understand the realm. And he says, we are in the middle of a revolution of consciousness, which I would say the Diamond Sutra, you know, 1800 years ago, was exploring in some depth. He says, over the past several years, geneticists, neuroscientists, psychologists, and so on, you know, are making great strides in understanding the building blocks of human flourishing. So this book is about human flourishing. How do we flourish? Why do we flourish? It presents a very optimistic picture of human beings, which is quite a wonderful antidote to what we read in the newspaper, which is war and pestilence and murder and crime. This is like the way that we fundamentally are wired to connect. Not to destroy, but to connect. And I understand there's a movie out now called I Am. Has anybody seen that movie? It's been, I had some good reviews about it. It's basically this movie director who did some of Carrie's early movies. He says, yeah, I'd be the last person you think would do this movie, but he got had a near-death experience. And he filmed a movie about the human condition, and it turned out to be extremely positive. See the movie. He says, we are primarily products of thinking that happen below the level of consciousness. This inner realm is illuminated by science, but it is not a dry mechanistic place. It is an emotional and enchanted place. This place that we try to touch. That we try to touch. We can't totally get it. That's what the Diamond Sutra is saying. Don't try to nail it down and conceptualize this realm. It's an enchanted place. If the study of the conscious mind highlights the importance of reason and analysis, study of the unconscious mind highlights the importance of passions and perception. And this is what the Diamond Sutra actually has to do with perception, how we perceive things. If the outer mind highlights the power of the individual, the inner mind highlights the power of relationships and the invisible bond between people. If the outer mind hungers for status, money, and applause, the inner mind hungers for harmony and connection. Those moments when self-consciousness fade away and a person is lost in a challenge, a cause, the love of another, or the love of God, or the divine, or the absolute. Then he goes about to say the way the mind actually works. It sends out millions of little, it's not like the general who sits on top of a platform and sees the world at a distance and analyzes. It's like the unconscious mind is like sending out a million little scouts all the time to make connections and figure out where the connections are. They scurry about, interpenetrating. What a great word, huh? We know that word. Interpenetrating other minds, landscapes, and ideas. And it comes back with information. So these signals don't control our lives, but they shape our interpretation of the world and they guide us. Like a spiritual GPS, as we chart our courses. If the general thinks in data and speaks in prose, the scouts crystallize with emotion and their work is best expressed in stories, poetry, music, image, power, and myth, and sutras like the Diamond Sutra. He didn't say that.
He didn't say that.
I looked at Bonnie and she went, oh my God. No, I'm sorry, I edited that a little bit for you. Okay. The research being done today reminds us of the relative importance of emotions over pure reason, social connections over individual choice, character over IQ, emergent organic systems over linear mechanistic ones, and the idea that we have multiple selves over the idea that we have a single self. My comment, the Diamond Sutra. If we want to put the philosophical implications in simple terms, the French Enlightenment, which emphasizes reason, loses. The British Enlightenment, which emphasizes sentiment, wins. Not an easy thing for an intellectual who basically studies politics. You know, he's trying to see what's beneath just this constant sort of contentious, which gives you kind of a knot in your stomach when you read it on television. Mm-hmm. But what's underneath it? What's actually trying to happen? We're trying to connect at some level, you know. Let's see here. Anyway, he goes on and talked about our educational system and how, you know, we teach so much about how about IQ and how to gain and work with data. But really, what's important, and there is a movement in that regard in a lot of different emergent areas, around emotional intelligence. Really trying to honor. And that's what we're doing in here. You know, that's what we're trying to honor and to work with. So, the Vajracchedika Sutra is trying to do this. It's trying to move us through its language. It's often difficult to understand language. It's trying to move us actually into a space, you know, by the use of the language where we can begin to relate to things differently than we traditionally relate to them. It basically cuts out all conceptual underpinnings. Whatever you're trying to define and say this is certain is trying to say, wait, there's a bigger picture here. Don't limit it. Subhuti is addressed, I didn't say this last week, Subhuti of the 10 major disciples is the one that is most developed in loving kindness and insight. So he's giving a very profound doctrine here to Subhuti. It's going to require great prajna, the development of prajna. Remember, this is part of the large 100-volume work of the Prajnaparamita literature, the literature of prajna, studying of wisdom. And Subhuti, because he has the ability to gain insight into this doctrine and translate it into loving kindness. So that's why he's the disciple that's been picked to actually help disseminate this particular doctrine. It's extremely radical. There's no dependence on any formulated teaching or doctrine or enumeration of truth. For truth being uncontainable and inexpressible. So basically what the sutra is saying is it is neither this and it is not this. So it requires a really a leap in how we approach things. This paper is this paper, and it is also not this paper. That's what it's asking us to begin to see things in that particular light. It's also asking us to see and try to understand, contrary to the way most religious doctrine is presented, is that salvation is not purchasable solely by good works. That primarily what it's approachable by is cultivating and internalizing and emanating in our everyday actions prajna, wisdom. So throughout the sutra, again and again, the Buddha denies the reality of predictable things like the ego or the soul of all appearances, merit, liberation, and non-liberation. And that there's no differentiation whatever between nirvana, the unborn, the primordial, the undifferentiated, the all-at-one-ment, and samsara, the born, the created, the shaped, the differentiated cosmos, which is, of course, what the Heart Sutra is saying, right? Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Heaven's not there, and earth or hell down here. The material world is here. It's one and the same. How do we find that together? So when we were 2 weeks ago, we explored, and I want to review it, reread the three sections, because the first four sections in this chapter really set forth the heart of the Diamond Sutra. And then the rest of the sutra, which we probably won't go through, enunciated in different contexts. So, he's talking about here, he says, however many species of living beings there are, whether born of eggs, from the womb, from moisture, or spontaneous, remember, just four lines of this. Remember how much four lines is worth in terms of value? However many species of living beings there are, whether born of eggs, from the womb, from moisture, or spontaneously, whether they have form or do not have form, whether they have perceptions or do not have perceptions, or whether it cannot be said of them that they have perceptions or that they do not have perceptions, we must lead all these beings to the ultimate nirvana that they so they can be liberated. So, not just human beings, everybody and everything, because we are everything. That's what's embedded in this statement. What a radical thing to say back in the 5th century Common Era. But then he goes on and says, after he says that, we need to liberate. We need to take this upon ourselves. He says, and when this innumerable, immeasurable, infinite number of beings, sentient and insentient, has been liberated, we do not think that a single being has been liberated. Right? So it's not like me, with my knowledge of Buddhism and the Diamond Sutra, is now going to go out and convert you and liberate you, which is, of course, a huge trap that religion falls into, right? What the sutra is addressing, that place in spiritual practice where we grasp on to the whole, our particular concept of what our spiritual practice is, and in fact, what is meant to liberate, in fact, begins to hinder, because we close down our particular around our particular ideology. That's not an easy doctrine, right? To tell religious people. But how liberating. Why is this so? If Subhuti, a bodhisattva, holds on to the idea that a self, a person, a living being, or a lifespan exists, that person is not an authentic bodhisattva. So there is the heart of the Diamond Sutra. And we talked about that last week. So he's basically deconstructing the idea that we have, which is the heart of the original Buddhist teaching, of the idea of a self, of something permanent, right? Or the idea of a person, that we are separate from this flower, or this floor, or the air. Or a living being, again, that living beings are separate from rocks or minerals. Or a lifespan, the idea that our particular life is constricted to this particular narrow time frame. That in fact includes way before our birth and way after our birth. And if we can begin to see everything within that realm of formlessness, then you begin to break down the distinction between me and you, us and them, my idea and your idea. That's the very heart of that statement. And then he goes on in number 10. He's now introducing the idea, he's further developing this concept into the wish list. Moreover, Subhuti, when a bodhisattva practices generosity, he does not rely on any object, which she was chanting about. That is to say, he does not rely on any form, sound, smell, taste, tactile object, or dharma. Dharma meaning both teaching, right? And dharma meaning like a dharma is also a mental construct to practice generosity. So here he's using the idea of generosity, which we talked about in 2 weeks ago, where the idea is how do we develop this idea of generosity, of wanting to give? Since everything goes to support me, can I care for everything? Can I care for everything with that kind of a spirit, rather than I'm a good person, and I'm going to help you, which you really need help. And aren't you grateful? And aren't I a good person? Which is what we all get trapped in, right? I mean, really, be honest. And shouldn't I get a little gratitude back for that, which is all part of the human process? But the Diamond Sutra is trying to take us way above that. Remember the example of the right hand doesn't expect thanks from the left hand, right? If it put some salve on it or takes care of it, right? This is what, in the 5th century, this sutra is trying to get us to begin to approach our spiritual practice. Because the heart, again, is that perception is based on an object, on the perceiver and the object of perception, and there begins to be a breakdown there. And what's difficult about the Diamond Sutra is beginning to get you to try to question your perception. What you perceive as real is not as real as you think it is. So it requires a huge amount of prajna. And what it's saying is, in the world, the way we course in the world with skill and spiritual integrity is by developing prajna, by being able to see what we see, but see it through the perception of not just our condition. That's a chair. Yes, that is a chair. But if we can begin to see it through also the lens of prajna, we see that, in fact, that chair is also Bob. And, in fact, the more we are... we see things through the lens of prajna, we probably see this as Bob even more than we see it as a chair. And then we can construct it back into a chair. So we can say, that chair is a chair, but it's also not a chair. I can say both, right? Bob is also Bob, but Bob is also not Bob. There's kind of a great story about that one. They were doing this little mono, this dialogue between Kala Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan teacher, and I think it was Sunsin, I don't know, who was a Korean Zen guy. So the Zen guys, you know, the Diamond Sutra is one of the main texts in the Zen tradition. So he's going, he's going to Kala Rinpoche, and they're going to have this little exchange, you know, this little Dharma combat. So he holds up this orange, he says, is this an orange or not an orange? You know, he's trying to get him. You know, it's like, if you say it's an orange, it's wrong, right? There's mangoes like this. If you say this is an orange, or if you say this is not an orange, it's wrong. That's where this is coming from, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Kala Rinpoche turns to his attendant and whispers something, because English wasn't good, and he says, hasn't he ever seen an orange before? Which is kind of really sweet, because he was like, you know, in some ways the whole thing was a little conceptual, right? And he was starting into this conceptual, and Kala Rinpoche kind of, you know, like, you know, he was going to come down, well, yeah, I mean, you know, the absolute, you know, it's an orange, right? I mean, that was kind of sweet. I just remember that story. Right. So, anyway... Here he's talking about the signless. He says, that is to say, he does not rely on any form, sound, smell, taste, tactile object, or dharma to practice generosity. But really, he's just using generosity as an example. It could be anything, right? When you practice the precepts, look at it through the signless. When you practice meditation, when you practice anything, put it through this filter of prajna. And the way you put it through the filter of prajna is, in the previous one, you take the four things that he said. Take every perception and put it through the filter of non-self, of not a person, of not a lifespan, right, and not a living thing. And also put it through the filter of not attaching, being in the realm of the signless. Don't be careful about putting any concept on your head. That doesn't mean that, you know, that doesn't mean that we don't use forms. We use forms and we need forms, but we don't cling to forms. We use our six senses, but we're not a slave to our six senses. We're very much in the world and engaged in the world, but we're not quite of the world. And that's one of the marks of a spiritual person. Is that you don't cling to the world. You enjoy it, you participate in it, but you also see it as a flash of lightning, as a dewdrop. So you can let things go. You don't put your refuge in conditioned things. When the Buddha was dying, you know, they were crying and weeping and letting it go, and that's appropriate. You know, grieving's appropriate. But he was reminding them, and he says, why? He says, remember what have I told you my whole life? Everything's conditioned. This body, the Nimanakaya body, is conditioned. It's going to fall apart. Remember, that's what I've been telling you. I'm actually living out what I've been telling you. I'm going to disintegrate in front of you, which is what everything is. So, yes, you can grieve me. Of course. You appreciate my teaching. You value it. But, you know, don't hang on too tight here. There'll be other Buddhas. The teaching will continue. It'll be all right. Let it go. Let it go. Let my body go. So then he says, let's see what else did I have about that. So when we look at things again, what he's saying is we see, especially when we see a person, for example, it's very easy for us to lock down around a certain perception of a person, particularly maybe our partner or our loved ones, that we have a very strong projection on. They should be this way, right? Or they are that way. And there's truth to that, what we perceive. But what we don't see, and what the sutras encouraging us to do, is to see them in so much a bigger construct. So instead of seeing their transgression, we see their history. We see their condition. We see their parents. You know, we see their culture. We see their heredity. We see all the factors that go to make this person up. We see our influence on them. And when we can see things like this through the realms of prajna, it's harder for us to walk down around this person did this, punish them. It so much more enables us to look at things through the lens of compassion. Because the Buddha is not identified through his marks, his physical marks. He says, don't look at me through my physical marks. You know, look at me through the unconditioned, the realm of the formless. Look at me through love and compassion. Because those are the things, like David Brooks is talking about, which connect. Those are the things which unify us. These are the unifying principles. And this is what the Diamond Sutra has tried to encourage us to do. So that's the science. So that's the essence of the Diamond Sutra. So we'll see. We won't go through the whole sutra, but we've turned enough phrases that we've, gained some of the jewels from the sands of the Ganges. when I used to practice, they don't do this at Zen Center anymore, I don't think, but we used to turn the Diamond Sutra, we used to read it as part of our morning service. You know, we just open our arbitrarily and read some of it. So maybe we'll do this. Maybe I'll Xerox a few of these out, and occasionally we'll call turning the sutra. You know, like in the Tibetan tradition, you know, they turn, you know, the little wheels, they turn, you know, well, there's sutras inside those wheels. And so instead of chanting them, you just turn the wheel and you're turning the sutra, right? You're disseminating these sutras out. Or, you know, that's what on these flags, they write parts of the sutra, and the wind is disseminating out. Well, we can turn it. But mostly what we're trying to do is we're trying to turn it